Later that night, back up on top of the hill, Dorothy was watching Jury put away her clothes. "Have you enrolled in any classes?" she asked. "No," Jury replied. "With only 2 weeks remaining in the term, there seemed little point. I don't know for certain that I will in D term either. Certainly not a full course load." She turned from her wardrobe with an ironic look on her face and said, "Miki may be brilliant enough to take on a full course load after such a massive change in his life, and Dutana and Sionji are crazy enough, but I'm neither." She gave Dorothy a thoughtful look. "Did you sleep at all last night?" Dorothy blinked at her as if she hadn't been expecting such a question. "No," she replied. "Why not?" Jury wanted to know. She smiled slightly. "Did I disrupt something by being here last night?" "No," Dorothy said again. Jury looked a little taken aback. "In that case, Caitlin's brother didn't know I was here, but he must have known you would be here. What gave him the idea that he could just barge right in at bedtime?" "Because," Dorothy replied flatly, "I belong to him." Jury's face darkened. "What? There isn't even a tournament here. There couldn't be. Anyway, he isn't even a student, let alone a duelist." Now it was Dorothy's turn to blink and look a little puzzled. "I don't understand what bearing that should have on anything. If he were a student, he would have his own bed. He wouldn't need to borrow mine. In any case, I fail to see what's so strange about it. I don't sleep, he does, and since he owns me..." A look of comprehension sparked on her face. "Oh, no one told you I'm a robot, did they?" It wasn't a question. Jury blinked. "A robot?" "Yes. Technically speaking, a biomimetic mechano-humanoid, F-type. I apologize. You should have been informed." There was a rather awkward pause. "Perhaps you'd like to look for somewhere else to stay," Dorothy added helpfully. "Are you throwing me out?" Jury inquired. "No, I have neither power nor desire to do so. I simply thought that, unfamiliar as you are with mechanoids, you might feel uncomfortable living with one and wish to leave. Since you are not a student, you should technically not be living here anyway. But I'm willing to overlook that in order to avoid unnecessary contact with the Department of Residential Services." Jury smiled slightly. "That's very kind of you," she said with mild sardony. "I'm trying to be a more social creature," Dorothy replied, deadpan. "Well, who am I to interfere?" Jury said. She sat down on her bed with a final sort of thump. "I'll stay here if you don't mind me," she went on. "It's been a while since I had a roommate, but you're quiet." "All right," said Dorothy agreeably. "Corwin will just have to find somewhere else to sleep." "Indeed," Jury replied, a faint shadow crossing her face, but if Dorothy noticed it, she made no sign. Then the tall redhead shook off whatever had occurred to her, got up, undressed, and put on the nightdress Kate had helped her pick out. The poor girl had been so flustered when asked her opinion. But then, Jury had noticed that Kate was a flannel pajamas kind of girl, much like her roommate. Utena Tenjo was a beautiful young woman, Jury reflected, but she wouldn't know what to do with beautiful clothes if they threw themselves at her. In a strange way, it was part of her charm. Dorothy, still fully dressed in her school uniform, despite the fact that it was Saturday night, sat in her desk chair, unconcernedly reading the next of her 20th Century Lit assignments. Jury paused for a moment with her hand near the light switch, then said, "I'm sorry, but I need to turn the light off if I'm to get any sleep myself." Dorothy looked up from her book and nodded. "Fine," she said, though she made no move to put the book down. Shrugging internally, Jury switched off the light, went to her bed, and lay down. From behind her, she heard a whir and a click, and faint blue-white light gleamed across her field of view. She turned her head to look, and saw that the band which held Dorothy's auburn bangs out of her eyes had extended forward, revealing what looked like an optical drive bay. The light shone out from within the drive bay, falling on her book and allowing her to keep reading. Jury went to sleep, musing on how odd it seemed that that didn't seem so odd. Breakfast on Sunday morning got off to an inauspicious start. Sunday breakfasts were always hit-or-miss affairs. Utina skipped the dining hall breakfast almost every morning, and on Sundays she tended not even to be up by the time Deka closed its doors on the breakfast crowd. Today, Caitlin was also having a lie-in, which disappointed Miki, since he'd climbed the hill partially in the hopes of talking to her at breakfast. It was Sionji's day off, so he was there. Jury had barged into the dining hall like she owned the place, her emerald glare daring the operator of the machine that goes ping to challenge her. He had taken a look and respectfully declined. Dorothy had tagged along, despite having nothing to do with herself at meals. Devlin trudged in 10 minutes later, looking as if he'd rather still be in bed. In fact, he would, but hunger had conquered him. Everybody else appeared to be giving it a miss. "Well, Mr. Kaworu," said Sionji after a few minutes of silently working on his rather cardboardish pancakes, "I'm surprised to see you here this morning." Miki went a trifle pink. "Why would you be?" he wondered, a trifle defensively. "I've always been an earlier riser than you." "True," Sionji replied equably, "but I've usually had the busier night." Miki opened his mouth to protest, just in time to provide a handy inlet for about a quarter of the full glass of water that was thrown in his face at that moment. "Ack!" he remarked, recoiling and sputtering. When he'd wiped the water out of his eyes with his napkin enough to see his assailant, he was startled to see Azelin Devir Natashkin holding the empty glass, her face wrathful. "I'm never speaking to you again, Miki Kaworu," she declared firmly. "I don't mind that you didn't want to be involved, but you could at least have said so, instead of saying you would, and then not showing up." Sionji turned a disappointed look on Miki. "You didn't show up? I thought you were supposed to be a genius." "I was going to," said Miki, as Azelin sat down across from him. She was pointedly not looking at him, her face turned away, eyes closed. "Really, I was. But by the time I had finally decided, it was too late. I lost track of time. It was rude of me not to call or something and tell you, though. He got to his feet, water still dripping down his face from his wetted bangs, and bowed. "I'm sorry. It was inexcusably rude of me." Azelin opened one eye and regarded him critically. Then a smile tugged at the corner of her mouth. "You're so cute," she said, breaking her standoffish tableau to rise and kiss him on the point of the nose. "Tell you what, you can make it up to me tonight."
Tonight?
He asked, flustered. "Sure," Azelin replied. "Spring Wind is a 3-night ceremony." Sionji nearly snorted his cornflakes. Jury glanced at Dorothy, who almost imperceptibly shrugged. Others started straggling in a bit after that. Mia and Moose came up from Galaxy House. Mia looked a bit concerned, Moose disgruntled. A disgruntled Moose, Dorothy had learned even in her short time in the house, was a bad but rare thing. She wondered what had caused it.
"I don't grudge anybody his religion," Moose grumbled, picking at a rubbery fried egg. "Except when his goddess tells him to get me up at 8 in the morning on a Sunday to tell me about her."
"The campus crusade for Kalidor again?" Dorothy inquired.
Said Moose. "That guy with the beard again. I guess he's their local high mucky muck or something."
"The campus crusade for what?" asked Jury.
"Kalidor," said Dorothy. "Standard language corruption of Khalid Jakor.
a warrior god worshipped by the primitive prehumanoids of Escher 3326, an undeveloped Paleolithic Class L world in the Outer Rim territories. The first survey group from Earth to 3326 in the standard year 2101 contained a remarkably incompetent comparative theologist named J.C. Barnard, who managed to misinterpret the native proto-sentience god of skull-smashing so wildly that his writings on the subject spawned a cult dedicated to the worship of a mother goddess with a similarly pronounced name. The Crusade for Kalidor was deemed a legal religion by Earthdome last year, and since then their devotees have been making pains of themselves in airports and on college campuses throughout the Earth Alliance. The cult seems especially attractive to disenfranchised teenagers and developmentally stunted adults without any other future prospects. Miki blinked. "I see," he said. "And they call my religion of suspect legitimacy," Azalin grumped. "Oh, but they're not screwing anyone, so it must be wholesome," she added, stabbing a fork angrily into the heart of a blueberry muffin. "That muffin never did anything to offend you," Sayanji said gently. "Shut up and take half," she snapped, and he obeyed with a meek expression. Dorothy nodded in response to Azalin's previous statement. "Kalidorians take a vow of celibacy," she confirmed. "It is the third of five vows, the first two being vows of poverty and obedience, the last two, proselytization and charity." "To the freaking Crusade elders," muttered Azalin. "See also poverty. Give your money to Kalidor. Give your money to the elder Barnard." She shook her head. "Sorry. The fact that those morons are a dome-supported religion while I get the third degree from Canadian customs just really rubs backward up my tail." Miki nodded. "I can see why." He was still a little pink at the coarseness of her earlier comment, but seemed to be recovering. Juri smiled a little to herself and added some sugar to her second cup of tea. Such a charming young man. "What do they want with you anyway, Moose?" Azalin wondered. "You're not rich."
"No, but I'm big. If Kalidor tells them to start breaking down doors and liberating people's stuff, I'm sure they'd like to have a Hoffmanite on staff. And since they've heard I'm kind of between religions, they figure, what the hell? I'm still trying to be polite, but pretty soon, if they don't lay off..." He shrugged his massive shoulders. "Maybe I'll sic to Kron on them. He can introduce them to the wonders of the Book of Jaquan."
That night at 8, Miki Kaworu walked across Institute Road to the electromagnetics lab, as nervous as the day he'd fought his first Rose duel. The location and appearance of the lab didn't help any. The original had been constructed in the almost unimaginably distant year of 1887, built entirely without iron, so that students and faculty could carry out delicate magnetic and electrical experiments. According to the Institute handbook, that hadn't worked out, and the building had seen several other uses, including serving as the laboratory of one of Earth's pioneering rocket scientists, before being given to Skull, a rather creepy-sounding secret honor society, for use as their shadowy headquarters. Like everything else in central Worcester County, the original building had been destroyed in 1992, and again in 1994. The third incarnation had never been used by Skull, since the Polytechnic Institute had chosen not to reoccupy the site after reconstruction was completed in 1996, and no other use had been found for it, so it simply stood, a dark little stone building tucked into a grove of trees at the base of Institute Hill. It wasn't all that far from Galaxy House, Institute Hall, or Founders Hall, but the trees and grass around it made it seem much more isolated than it was, and in the dark it was positively eerie. Azalin had faced quite a wrangle just getting permission to practice her religion on campus, since certain aspects of it were in violation of the laws of the Commonwealth of Massachusetts. Religious freedom had won out in the end, but only with the insistent stipulation, originated by Professor Aaron Harris of the Humanities and Arts Department, that her activities be confined to a suitably private site.
The derelict electromagnetics lab was perfectly suited, so it had been designated the local Dentrovian temple, never mind the fact that Dentrovians don't build temples, and she had been instructed to keep her ceremonies to herself. Azalyn frequently ignored this instruction. She'd celebrated holidays at Bancroft Tower, and in the gardens behind Higgins House, and on the roof of Daniel's Hall, and in the Alden Memorial Bell Tower, and in several other places the administration, or at least Professor Harris, would not strictly have approved of. Still, in the cold parts of the year, it was nice to have a place of certain availability and privacy to fall back on, and for the really important things she did use it. Besides, she liked the little building. It had a certain rather gloomy charm, sort of like Sionji on his bad days. And the summoning of the spring wind was certainly important. Without it, according to the elder legends, spring wouldn't come, and without spring, the harsh Dentrovian winter would continue unabated for all eternity. Summoning spring was hardly something to slack off about. The previous night's opening segment had been rather spoiled by Azalyn's peek at Mickey having stood her up. She was hopeful that she could recover what ground she'd lost tonight and make everything all right again. Not that she was afraid winter wouldn't end if she didn't. It was the principle of the thing. But still. She opened the laboratory's heavy wooden door to his tentative knock, dressed in a heavy green cloak with a short overcape, and smiled brightly to see him. "Hi. I'm glad you came," she said. "Come on in." Mickey stepped across the threshold and looked around in surprise. From outside, the electromagnetics lab lived up to its old Honor Society nickname, Skull Tomb. Inside, it was rather nice, if you liked the old-fashioned drafty castle style. The central room was flagstoned and clear of obstructions, and candles stood in holders and guttered in sconces all over the place, filling the room with a yellowish glow that made it feel warmer than it really was. Cushions in bright colors lay here and there. It was a little creepy, but homey at the same time. "What should I do?" Mickey asked, keeping his voice hushed out of deference to the place's quiet, reverential atmosphere. "You don't need to whisper," Azalyn replied, grinning. "Come on in, take off your coat and shoes, and sit down anywhere. I want to explain a few things before we start." Mickey nodded. That suited him fine. He did as he was asked, unconsciously choosing a bright blue cushion that matched his hair. Azalyn crossed in front of him, smiling, and sat down opposite him across the circle. As she sat, her cloak ruffled a little, then settled around her, and he blinked. For just an instant, he had imagined that she wasn't wearing anything underneath it. Must have been a trick of the light, the rumors running away with his imagination. "Now," said Azalyn, putting her fists under her chin and smiling across at him. "You've probably heard all kinds of weird things about Dentrovians. The rumors go around campus every couple of months, and since you've been hanging around with Katie and all, Liza Broadbitch will have made sure they got back around to you." Mickey allowed that this was so, nervously adding that he certainly didn't believe that... "Well, that's all right," Azalyn interrupted him, "because a lot of them are true, at least as far as they go. It's the details they get wrong, but the details are the most important thing." Mickey blinked again. "You mean you do?" Azalyn nodded. "We do, yes. But that doesn't mean you must, all right? That's the first and most important thing you have to learn about being here with me. You don't have to do anything, anything at all, that you don't feel like doing. If it seems right to you that all you do tonight is sit there and watch, that's fine. If it seems right to leave, that's fine too. Or have some bread and sing, but nothing more. Or anything else you want to. The only restrictions are that you mustn't hurt anyone, and that includes yourself. Lying to yourself is hurting yourself. So is doing something you don't want to do. So is not doing something you do want to do. Understand?" I think so, but I have to be very careful here on Earth," Azalyn told him solemnly. "Earth's human civilization and its many descendants throughout the galaxy have a common problem interpreting that one aspect of my faith.
The majority of humans either read too much into it or not enough. And finding humans with inner balance enough to walk the path with me is very, very difficult. Early on, I made a few misjudgments. I got hurt once, and another time had to hurt someone to escape worse. She gestured at the room, empty but for the two of them. In my hometown on Dantrov, there would be 100. In one of the great cities, perhaps 10,000, at this single observance. Some would watch, some would leave, some would have bread and sing, nothing more. But all would be here for the right reasons. Here I usually celebrate alone. I would have no shortage of volunteers if I made the great festival days known, but screening out those who volunteered simply because they thought it would be fun to try an alien girl for the change would take so long that the effort would be worthless. I have friends who have found a connection to one or the other of the great festivals, but none who can fully embrace my ways. I mention this only to let you know that I don't expect you to. Miki nodded. It struck him as a little odd, but as she went on, he felt his discomfort with the awkward subject easing. She had no awkwardness about it, after all, and she was laying it out to him straight. This is the way I am. It causes me difficulties in your society, but I won't change because of that. I know who I am, and if you can't handle that, that's your problem. He found the viewpoint admirable and enviable. How much had he and his peers at the academy last year struggled with questions of identity, questions of faith? How much did they struggle with them still? Only Sayanji seemed to have found some measure of peace. Well, Sayanji and Utena. She had won the tournament, setbacks at the finish aside. And as for him, he had met Azalin. Miki stopped his watch, observed the reading, and smiled. I understand, he said. Azalin smiled back, her golden eyes gleaming in the candlelight. Would you like something to drink? If you decide to sing, it'll be thirsty work. Yes, please. The next week was, mercifully, quieter. R. Dorothy Wainwright and Devlin Carter fitted easily into Professor Ravi Chandrajan's division of 20th Century Earth Literature II. Unlike Professor Aaron Harris, who had bounced them from his division, Professor Chandrajan seemed delighted to have a Turing candidate machine intelligence in his class. When Harris, rather pettily, Devlin thought, refused to forward Chandrajan his two exiles' grades in the course so far, Professor C., as he was known, took their copies of returned course materials at face value and made up the rest accordingly, installing both as solid A students with 2 weeks remaining in the term. The fencing club was quiet, and Liza Broadbank's student rag, The Beacon, took the week off from its usual pattern of character assassination and rumor-mongering about Caitlin and her friends. Jacron of Galaxy House had nothing to be outraged about for 4 whole days, until he learned of some horrible injustice being perpetrated on Division C of the Advanced Biochemistry Laboratory Group, about which nobody else cared to get the details, that put him in a comfortable dudgeon to round out the week. Mac McKenzie, his roommate, was relieved by this turn of events, since when Jacron had nothing about which to be outraged, he was one miserable narn. Miki Koru and Caitlin continued to work on their collaborative piece for the Institute Symphony Orchestra's spring concert, coming up in a mere 2 months. Miki was fitting into the band quite nicely. Before week's end, he was named deputy student conductor, a position formerly occupied as a mere formality by Moose McEachern, and given up with insistent grace. Though the two student conductors never discussed openly the conversation they'd had on that bleak Thursday evening, those around them could tell that something about that night had linked them more strongly together. It came out in their music and the way they worked on it together. It wasn't a romantic sort of attachment, but Azalin, for one, wasn't about to grudge it that. She saw any bond between people as a thing to rejoice in. Miki himself seemed more relaxed, more animated, than he had been in previous weeks. Maybe it was the presence of another of his old schoolmates, his only real friend at Otori Academy besides Utena, Anthy, and
sometimes, his sister. Maybe it was just the brightening of life that comes with the easing of winter, for the winter of 2404-2405 seemed determined to fizzle out in February, rather than, as Worcester winters sometimes did, lingering doggedly into April. Or maybe it had something to do with Azalin. He did go to the third and final night of Spring Wind, after all. The two didn't discuss it, and no one else, not even Sionji, made so bold as to ask. The upcoming weekend was the last before finals week, and so the Duelist Society and their friends were determined to get in as much concerted recreation as possible before buckling down and getting ready to wind up C-term with style. They had a good opportunity to do it, too. The Art of Noise were playing the Worcester Artists Group Hall on Saturday night. Corwin and Noll came on Friday night once more, armed with a full weekend pass, with permission to miss school on Monday, from the powers that be and ready to help them waste their time. He also carried with him a letter for Caitlin from their father, which Kate opened in the wedge. "What's that?" Utina asked her roommate as Kate finished reading the letter itself and unfolded a thin pink sheet of paper stamped with the great seal of Avalon County.
"A DMV auth token," Kate replied, grinning as she read it over.
"A what?" Utina returned. "Pre-approved authorization from the Department of Motor Vehicles to take the Class C driver's license test," Corwin explained. "You can take the license test remotely using SimSense VR," he went on to her still puzzled look, "if you've got a pre-auth from the DMV. That's how I did mine. The department likes it. They can more accurately gauge your response to emergencies without actually putting you in danger that way. Kate's got a 1 week window to pass or file for an extension."
"She can take it from here?"
"Any place the net goes, if you've got the right equipment," Corwin replied. "Dad said he thought they had a SimSense deck here you could use, Kate?"
Kate nodded. "The media center has one," she replied. "Or I could borrow Edwards."
She grinned at the paper again.
"Dad's up to something, isn't he?" she asked.
Corwin shrugged expansively, jostling Noll enough that the dragon claimed it as his token excuse to desert for Utrina's shoulder instead. Corwin gave him the requisite dirty look, and then professed his innocence of any parental plans.
"All I know is, he said you should give it a shot before finals. Maybe you can rent a car and go someplace for spring break."
Maybe, Kate agreed. Then she grinned at Utina.
Toronto?
"Sounds good to me. If I survive our GH203 final, I'm going to need Toronto." The Art of Noise put on a good show at the WAG, the best since their triumphant performance the previous A-term at Sneaky D's. They unveiled two new songs, both Kaworu Hutchins collaborations, and Kate declared her attempt at interesting Miki in rock music successful when she saw him, filling in for Edward at the engineer's board, grooving down with the riff they'd put together with Azalin for Deconstructionist Duelist's Blues. Halfway through the show, they busted out a secretly rehearsed cover of the Ozzy Osbourne classic Crazy Train, with a tongue-in-cheek dedication to Sionji. When she sang it, Kate took off her glasses and somehow managed to look so suitably demented during the refrain that Utina, Corwin, and Noll, along with the joke's intended victim, were all sent into helpless hysterics at the long-since-sold-out Art of Noise gear table. She declined to bite the head off the fake canary Azalin had dug up someplace, though, much to the guitarist's disappointment. After that, it was off to the IBGF's traditional celebratory dinner spot, the Eternal Pings, for the second Saturday night in a row. The manager knew it was the eve of finals week and gave them free crab rangoons. Sionji and Miki, still cranked up on the adrenaline high of the concert like all the rest of them, got into a deep philosophical discussion over the merits of that redoubtable appetizer. Both championed its essential goodness and rightness, but their viewpoints differed slightly as to just why it was the ultimate deep-fried foodstuff. Sionji maintained it was their succulent, delicious filling. Miki insisted that their crisp yet tender crust deserved the honor.
The discussion ended with one ex-counselor challenging the other to a duel, which almost made Utena spray Amanda Dessler with tea. It soon became clear that neither was actually upset, though they were apparently going through with the duel anyway, just for the hell of it. Sunday morning dawned bright, brisk, and cheerful on Galaxy House. Moose McEachern awoke early for a change, smiled at the warm, welcoming shafts of light working their way through the house's windows, and decided to cook himself a nice, old-fashioned Hoffman breakfast. He turned the heat off of his extra-large wiffle fruit omelet, 8 eggs, just like Mom used to make, just in time for the kitchen to become crowded. The smell of breakfast awakened Chakron first. He, disdaining breakfast on what he called religious grounds, popped briefly into the shower. Mac, awakened by Chakron, staggered over to the coffee maker, turning out a viscous black substance which could have been used either as a beverage or hydraulic fluid. Mia and Miki each retrieved a bowl of cereal from the cabinet, while Sky made it no further than the common room before rushing back to his room for sketchpad and charcoal. Moose watched his fellow residents as he ate, smiling gently between bites of Hoffman cuisine as Miki timed his own consumption of shredded wheat, as Sky rapidly sketched the light and shadows of the common room, as Chakron and Mac both retired to their room for a day of study, and finally as Sky, Mia, and Miki departed for Alton Hall to begin preparations for the day's duel. Moose rushed through the last couple of eggs worth of his omelet, deciding that, since he was up abnormally early anyway, he might as well join them. He was placing his plate in the dishwasher, contemplating mellifluous phrases to open the Crab Rangoon showdown, when the knock came at the door. Moose glanced at the clock on the recently abused coffee maker. 8 a.m., almost to the tick. Under his breath, he muttered a few choice phrases from colony-era Hoffman literature before standing up, stretching, and walking with great reluctance to the front door. Maybe, just maybe, it was something bearable, like an encyclopedia salesman. The door, once opened, revealed 2 young men wearing white shirts and black ties with +4 pants. Each held a handful of tracts in his hand, and both had the all-too-toothy smiles and utterly vacant eyes of the truly dedicated Kalidor missionary. Moose barely had time to toy with the fantasy of slamming the door in and through their faces before the taller of the 2 otherwise identical young men spoke. "Ah, Mr. McEachern, it is so good to see you again. I hope you have had the opportunity to read through the tracts we left with you last Sunday." "No," Moose said politely, drawing out the syllable as he tested his resolve. The punishment he was about to inflict should, he felt, be outlawed by the Galactica Accords as needlessly cruel. "I'm afraid I have discovered a new religion which occupies all my free time at the moment. Have you gentlemen considered the Way of Jaquan?" The shorter of the 2 missionaries managed to squeak out a shocked, "Jaquan!" before his companion stepped heavily on his instep. As Shorty tried not to hop or scream, Stretch smiled pleasantly and continued, "Ah, but surely the Way of Jaquan does not supply the peace of mind, the calm reassurance of Kalidor. After all..."
"Quite an intriguing notion, my good man," Moose smiled. "However, there is one in this household who would be far more capable of describing Jaquan's teachings. I have, of course, only begun my studies. Allow me to introduce you to him." With gentle firmness, Moose grasped a hand in each of his own heavy fist and irresistibly led the 2 followers of Kalidor to the door of 22S2. "Oh, Jaquan, might I come in? I would like to introduce you to 2 prospective students of Jaquan and the Prophets."
The missionaries weren't teleported through the door, but in the blur of door opening, Narn pulling them through and Moose following after, they couldn't tell the difference.
"Ah, welcome, welcome! I am more than pleased to educate any willing student on the teachings of Jaquan, ecstatic even! Ah, those poor souls who lacked the vision of the Prophet, the great and noble hero who lifted the shadows from our ancient world and ushered in a new dawn of learning and spirituality!"
"Actually..." Stretch, the tall missionary, sensed that he had lost the momentum in this meeting. but his efforts to recover were brushed aside, as Jacron continued, rushing to the desk and pulling out a leather-bound, much-read copy of a D-shaped book.
"Here, there's a line for that. Pardon me, just one moment."
Jacron's manic activity and near-constant exclamations,
"Aha! Hmm! Aha!"
prevented any interruptions before he found his chosen page.
"Ah! Here it is! The very quote! There is a greater darkness than the one we fight. It is the darkness of the soul that has lost its way."
"Very insightful, but..."
"Ah, you would not believe how many souls there are which have no way, which seek direction, inspiration, dare I say, revelation, and it lies here, in the life and the teachings of the prophet Jacron and his contemporaries."
"That's what we..."
"Jacron was able to see into the minds of the people," Jacron continued. "See within and discover the inner truths which bind all sentient beings together in symbiosis. He taught us that the true fight, the battle for freedom, arises not out of fear, but out of hope, from the belief in a better tomorrow. Jacron has inspired generations of Narns, and other beings,"
Jacron added as an afterthought, totally missing Moose's beatific nod of agreement.
"Inspired generations to find hope and to persevere against great burdens and incredible odds, to battle injustice while retaining peace within and without. The battle to make the world better must begin with this, the resolve not to make the world any worse. This is Jaquan's wisdom. This is his calling."
"We have someone else who calls."
"And history!"
Jacron spun on his feet, gesturing towards the missionaries with his copy of the Book of Jacron.
"Within this volume can be found the rise of the Narns from their dark age, of their struggle against mythic foes of incalculable power, and the defeat of the enemies of envy, hatred, and aggression by the prophets. Such a metaphor for this age, indeed for any age."
"Speaking of..."
"And even the other prophets of the day honor Jacron."
Without setting down the book, Jacron drew out another, thinner book from the desk, gesturing with it.
"Jacquath, the prophet who founded the modern Narn system of justice, derives virtually every one of his basic postulates from the teachings of Jacron. Between the two of them, they define a way of life which cannot help but lead to enlightenment. It is a long path, and requires much meditation and study, but the wisdom of Jacron can, in the end, solve any problem."
Moose watched with amusement as Jacron continued, foiling the every effort of the missionaries to break in through sheer zeal and bluster. He didn't plan to stick around, however. If and when one of the missionaries got a word in edgewise, Jacron would really kick into high gear, and the one thing worse than a ranting Narn is a proselytizing Narn. As he prepared his excuses in his mind, Moose noted Mac attempting to study by his bed. To untrained eyes, the attempt was successful, but the slight hunching of Mac's shoulders, the death grip he held on his chemistry book, informed Moose that the young man wanted to be anywhere but here at the moment. As he watched, Mac looked up at Moose and stared for a second with an indecipherable expression. "Say, Moose," Mac said quietly, "don't we have a bass lesson today?" The strange expression was gone as soon as Mac's lips began moving. In its place was a perfect look of innocence, the look of someone just remembering something important.
"You know, that's quite right," Moose nodded. "And we'll have to hurry to get to Alton. We might get in an hour of practice before the duel."
Jacron paused in his preaching and stared at the two.
"But I've just begun describing Jaquan's wisdom," he exclaimed. "Couldn't your lesson wait until after finals?"
"My sincere apologies, Jacron," Moose sighed, his language becoming increasingly flowery in response to Jacron's own. "But the Art of Noise may have an engagement in the near future which I will not be able to meet, and my understudy must be adequate to fill in. And since I will not see Mac between finals and the start of D-term, I think a double session will be required today. Rest assured, however, that I will come to you with any questions I may have about my studies of the laudable prophet Jacron. Mac, shall we go?"
Jacron shook his head, the disappointment obvious.
Ah, well, at least you two gentlemen will be glad to hear more of Jaquan's words.
With barely a pause for breath, he was off again, and even as Moose and Mac closed the door to 22S2, his voice could be faintly heard, extolling the virtues of a Narn dead for a millennium. As Moose and Mac began to trudge up the hill toward Alden, Moose muttered,
I was about to bring up the duel, but I'd totally forgotten that you weren't with us last night. That story about bass lessons was inspired.
Story hell, Mac replied. After the duel, you're going to help me pick out a practice instrument, and you're going to teach me. Jacron is going to want to know all about those lessons, and besides... Mac smirked wryly at Moose as he added, You owe me for bringing those two into my room and setting Jacron off.
Well, I'm sorry, said Moose. He shrugged, a motion which resembled nothing so much as continental drift, and went on, But it had to be done.
Understood, Mac nodded. But I just wish it didn't have to be done in my room. After a few moments of silence, Moose added,
Can you play the bass guitar?
Don't know, Mac replied. Never tried.
Ah, Moose grunted and said no more.